You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
Tuesday, 6 May, we had Palantir results after the close last night. They raised guidance as revenue up 39% beat expectations. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Chantal Marks, F&B Wealth and Investment. Goldfields doing another acquisition. I don't know, shouldn't we? More greenfields. And the Astro update, unchanged from February, but a tough space. Peter Armitage from Anchor on the Buffett Return. Retirement announced over the weekend. Tembo and Corsi Pansy, he is from the National Automobile Dealers Association. We're seeing some momentum in vehicle sales. The podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. Ramakopa distances ministry from City of Joburg's controversial prepaid electrical surcharge, and the city wants to increase it from 200 to 270 rand a month. Business Day, Exxaro loses another executive amid leadership shakeup. Company reaches an amicable agreement with their chief coal operations officer. Morning markets, the US was red, S&P down 0.6%, NASDAQ off 0.7%. The East is green, Sydney up 0.25%, Tokyo is closed again, this time it is greenery day. Hong Kong is up 0.8% and Tencent up 1.1%. Commodities mostly green, gold futures $3,370 an ounce, Brent 61.24, platinum 974, palladium down at 950. Rand is 18.28, Bitcoin 94,400, and top 40 opening call, 2 points to the red, which is no percentage point change.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Turning now with Chantal Marks, Head of Research, F&B Wealth and Investments. Chantal, appreciate the early morning time. Goldfields announcing that they're going to be acquiring Australian gold miner Gold Road Resources. It's about a $44 billion deal. They did one about 6 months ago, which was the Osika mining for about $25 billion. Nice looking deals. My concern perhaps is that I get why they want to go and buy production, because it's nice, it's easy, it adds some ounces and profitability to their book. Surely we need more greenfields. At this point, we're just shuffling chips around the table.
So I think what gets announced and what gets the kind of grabs the headlines is these big kind of acquisitions of existing mines. Mm. But what kind of fades into the background, into the appendices of the annual reports of most of these gold mining companies and mining companies in general, is the loads of work that's being done in brownfields expansion. So those are expansion projects at existing mines to increase the life of those mines. And to look for additional ounces. And then also the greenfields expansion project. So greenfields expansion basically means you're setting up a new mine. But what happens before a greenfields project actually starts being developed is a lot of exploring and a lot of information that needs to be gathered in order to make sure that this thing is feasible. And we know from previous mining cycles, you really want to make sure your expansion project is feasible. So some of these guys do have big projects and development projects ongoing. But I think the other reason why South Africans don't necessarily see it is because it's not happening here.
I take your point on that. But I see what you're saying about the brownfields. I mean, I think the goldfields, their Chilean mine, which they did a greenfields on, I think it took 13 years. I mean, and no one knows where gold is in 13 years. But I suppose it is that brownfields. It is saying, you know, let's take an existing mine and make it a bit bigger. It doesn't, to your point, get the headlines, but it does bring more production into the market. And that is, I suppose, the key focus for miners. It's easier, less risky.
It is less risky because you can share infrastructure that's already there. I mean, as you go through these annual reports and you actually read about some of these brownfields expansion projects, a lot of it is just, it's not even that expensive. So I think that that's why they're doing it. But to your point on the acquisitions, I think the acquisitions are – kind of telling us where we are in the cycle at the moment, particularly if you look at the prices that these gold miners are willing to pay for these assets. Yeah. It's pretty expensive. So, I think that we can start thinking about the top. Lots of uncertainty out there. Gold price still being supported at current levels, but the activities of these guys by buying up kind of additional ounces at pretty high valuations. It's almost like a bit of a canary in a coal mine, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And yes, they all in sustained costs are cheap, but to your point, they're paying top dollar for the ounces they will get. To quickly change track, Astral trading update out. Initially, the market hated it, which was weird because it was the same update from February. Then the market seemed to realize that point. Short version, however, tough being a chicken producer in the current environment.
It's tough being a chicken producer generally, I think, particularly in the South African context, because you are kind of fighting with everything that's going on from an infrastructure perspective. Mm-hmm. Load shedding had a big impact on these companies, deteriorating water and road infrastructure also having an impact on where these guys are operating, which is mainly in rural areas. And then you have these cheap imports to deal with. You also have a consumer that's been under pressure for a really long time. So additional protein isn't really being consumed at this point in time. I think that if you can start seeing economic growth in South Africa and demand for protein increasing, these guys will do quite well, particularly if that kind of poultry master plan is properly implemented and these guys get the protection that they need. But it is a volatile industry. Mm. Their input costs are very volatile and seasonal. So yeah, I mean, it's up 1 year, down 1 year, and unfortunately this half at least it seems to be down again.
Yeah, it is volatile and as you say, a lot of moving parts, and in this case most of them moving against the company. Chantal Marks, Head of Research, FNB Wealth and Investment. Appreciate the early morning. The Standard Flexible Income Fund is designed for pre- and post-retirement income and capital preservation needs. Retire without regret with Stanlib Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now. On the money.
I'm chatting with Peter Armitage, CEO, founder of Anchor. Peter, appreciate the time. The weekend was the Omaha, it's sort of, I don't know what we call it, the rock fest of capitalism with Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway. The big news was that he's retiring. He'll be gone by the end of the year. And it really does. I mean, we all knew at some point he would step down. Charlie Munger passed away 2 years ago. It is the end of an immense legacy.
Absolutely, Simon. I think he'll be 95 by the time he retires. You know, if you put that in context, most other CEOs retire at kind of max 65. So that's another 30 years or 50% of a working life. And I think there's an oft-quoted fact. He's made 90% of his money after he turned 50.
And that's just it. I mean, there's lots we learn from him. One of them is, and we all talk about it, it's nothing new, but I suppose he is the example of that compounding power. I mean, given enough time, we can all create vast amount.
Yeah, it's all very well to say he made 90% after the age of 50, but he's worth $170 billion today. Which means, you know, 45 years ago, he was worth $17 billion, which still would have put him probably in the top 100 people in the world. But absolutely, I mean, that simple rule of thumb, you know, 15% a year doubles your money in 5 years, 10% a year doubles your money in 7 years. And you just do that maths over a generation. Certainly in our business, we see wealthy people, you know, his parents put money away 50 years ago, and it's worth enormous sums today.
Part of Warren Buffett's, I don't know, part of his allure was that he wasn't flashy. He felt very old school type of investing. You didn't get the sense that he had Cray computers and AI behind him. It really was just the old fashioned. I mean, one of the comments he made in the weekend, he likes to start by reading the last 10 years of balance sheets, which is deeply old school.
Yeah, I think the temptation is, and I certainly think of my own career, you naturally want to invest in new things and new fads and venture capital and small businesses. Mm. But there's a lot to be said for size and critical mass and scale is a very powerful influence in business. And I think he appreciated that and wanted people to have proved themselves before he invested with them. And Apple is your best example. At one stage, Apple was 40% of Berkshire Hathaway, but he only invested in many, many years after it had been a success.
Is part of his success going to give challenges to Greg Abel, who's the heir apparent? I mean, what I mean by that is just the size. And Buffett's always said, I mean, they've got to really do big acquisitions. They're sitting on giant amounts of cash. They just are maybe too big.
Yeah, I mean, they're sitting with $350 billion of cash. So any business to move the needle has got to be pretty significant. And, you know, certainly all his wise sayings, and he's probably the most quoted investment person ever. But there's no doubt that his age and conservatism, you know, his conservatism grew a little bit with age, and he's been very hesitant to make big new investments other than Apple over the course of the last decade. And, you know, I think he'd made his money, and I think he said to an investors, you know, just be patient. I think he invested a lot in 2008, you know, less so in 2020. And I'm thinking of the big market declines, because that's when he tends to make his big cash. And I think he was probably anticipating another crash investing opportunity along the way and stayed in cash. But the markets, you know, in the last decade, when the markets declined, it's bounced back pretty sharply. And you had to move very quickly to make big investments. And also, to make a really big investment takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
Especially if you're buying a business.
Yeah. And I'd actually forgotten about 2008. He did some really clever deals with options and all sorts. But as you say,
the banks.
He made an absolute packet in it. And is part of it, I mean, I think two parts to this question. One is around process and almost repeatability of that process, which is perhaps easier as well with permanent capital. I mean, he can sit with cash, which is truthfully a drag, because of permanent capital.
One of the great secrets of his business was he had an insurance business. I mean, the way to picture is you pay your short-term insurance, they keep the money.
Yeah.
And you might claim in 6 months and 12 months and 18 months, but there's a permanent pool of cash. And in the asset management world, if I run a fund and do very badly, people take their money away. His float from his insurance business was permanent capital. There was no pressure ever to invest. And not having to deal with the month-to-month returns coming through, I think it's much easier to make a return. Not to say that myself or anybody in, you know, the SA investment world could have achieved what he achieved. But if you've got the luxury of time or your own money and you can be more patient with it, I mean, often some of the greatest investments in the world don't do well for a year or two or 3 years. But fund managers have often sold and moved on because they're under performance pressure. They're having to report monthly to trustees or to clients in terms of how they're doing relative to benchmarks. And he's never had that pressure.
And is that perhaps one of the advantages of private clients? And often folks will say, oh, the smaller private client can go in the small cap space, and that's well and good. But our key advantage perhaps is that it's our capital, it's permanent. As long as we can stomach the underperformance or drawdown and be skilled enough, we can do well.
Yeah, I think the combination of that is sticking with quality.
Yeah.
The converse of that is, you know, you make a bad investment and you stick with it for 5 years because you're waiting for it to come right.
Yeah.
I think Buffett placed a big premium on growth and good quality businesses that continue growing. And, you know, happy to pay a fair price for those rather than pay a cheap price for a bad business. Mm. That was one of his other big lessons. Mm. So compounding works, but only if you're in a quality growing business.
Yeah, if you're in the dogs.
It's your enemy. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're with the dogs, you just, what it's, I forget who said it, but you just end up with fleas.
Fees as well.
A last point, this is very much around process. And I imagine this is something which you and your colleagues at Anchor sort of very much instilling. You don't want to be the one-hit wonders. It's about that process. It's around instilling a repeatability into that process, which is so hugely important.
Yeah, I think process is very important, and understanding how you're investing and what your principles are and saying no to things. And I think where Buffett did particularly well was saying no to things. He must have been presented with every opportunity in the world. Very selective in terms of the things that pass through the process and pass through the criteria. And no fads and nothing, a big point that he did as well, nothing that he couldn't understand. You know, if you couldn't explain something to him, the elevator pitch, you know, in a minute, and he didn't get it, he walked away. You know, for example, Bitcoin was way off his radar. He's never interested in doing something he couldn't understand and something without a yield.
Yeah, absolutely. And he totally skipped the .com, which at the time seemed crazy, but in hindsight worked. We'll leave it there. Peter Armitage, CEO Anchor, always appreciate the insights.
Give your money the return it wants without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
Chatting now with Timmy Nkosi-Pansy, Vice Chairperson at the National Automobile Dealers Association. Timmy Nkosi, appreciate the time. April 2025, vehicle sales, 42,401 sales. This is up almost 12% over the previous period in 2024. That in itself a good number, although actually this April was a slightly shorter trading month because of where Easter was last year. The short version is vehicle sales are, I don't know if we want to call them robust, but they certainly got some momentum in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. You've nailed it there. Thank you so much, Simon. It's great to be on your show. Yeah, look, this was a very pleasant surprise to even the most avid industry observers. As you've mentioned, that the month of April 2025 had lesser trading days as compared to 2024 for the same period. And to get 12% increase in vehicle sales is really a pleasant surprise, but a very much welcome one because the industry needs it.
The industry does need it. The other perhaps key point is that we're kind of shopping a little bit cheaper. Deal size down 8.6% year on year. That is, I suppose, in part a consumer under pressure. In part, it's also telling us about the range of vehicles. And here particularly, obviously, the cheaper vehicles coming from most notably China, but also India, which is, you know, really good for the consumer. I mean, choice is great.
Yeah, absolutely. I can agree with you more. And that's a conversation I was having with the other media not long ago, to say that the consumers have faced so many challenges when it comes to financial constraints. Post-COVID, I mean, we had the two-piston as well, just to try and cushion the consumers. And to have these options in the automotive sector is good for the consumer. It is also good for our dealer partners, because at the end of the day, they need to keep the doors open. They employ people in those businesses, and they need to turn their stock. Now, to have a options like we have currently in the country, I mean, it's first of its kind. And of course, Chinese brands have come in very, very strongly with the offering, and also they've kind of like hit the market in the right spot in terms of your compact SUV. So are the Asian brands and the Japanese brands. And I mean, if you look at Suzuki numbers, you know, they are like skyrocketed simply because people could no longer afford more expensive and more luxurious vehicles, not because they don't want those brands, they do, but the financial constraints that we've all been experiencing have forced the consumers to look at alternatives, and the alternative are there in numbers currently, which is great for the automotive industry, great for the consumers, and also it's good to keep the economy going.
Absolutely. And what struck me, and I was doing some digging around yesterday evening for researching for this interview, electric vehicles, which I would have said to you, there's nothing happening out there. The numbers might not be big, but I mean, there are 600,000 electric vehicles available in South Africa, which was eye-opening to me, and is going to be, I suspect, a huge growth part of for the industry in the years and, truthfully, decades ahead.
Absolutely. I think the South Africans, we take some time to warm up to certain changes, and no doubt, you know, the electric vehicles, we're taking our time to warm up to them. And if you look at the numbers that have come out, your hybrid sort of vehicles are the ones that are really the electric cars numbers up. A fully electric vehicle, not that much, but your hybrid, we call them HEVs, they are the ones that are pushing these numbers up, and people are finding, again, alternatives in that space. And I think also just to notice, you know, the passenger car segment represent a 17% increase in April sales figures, which is phenomenal. And then also, I mean, 88% of the vehicle sales were coming from the dealers. And for me, that is exactly what we want to see. We want to see our dealers being the one that are pushing these numbers. And of course, now with the other alternatives of hybrid vehicles and the likes, this is really good for the consumers and good for us to move ahead and move to the future of electric or energy vehicles, call them.
Agreed 100%. A quick last question. Light commercial vehicles up 3.2%, not as much as the passenger vehicles. But I looked at that and I thought, that tells me a story that suggests that perhaps the business and industry in South Africa is not as I don't want to say not as struggling, but it shows some light at the tunnel if there's an increase in LCV vehicles.
Absolutely. I think you're the expert here, Simon. Absolutely spot on. I mean, 3.2% year-on-year increase in light commercial vehicle, one cannot take that lightly. very well where our economy is, the global economic challenges and political landscape we're operating in, the tariffs and the likes. To get 3.2% increase in passenger, so that's what the light commercial vehicles, it shows that, you know, there's some encouragement pointing to an economy that is better shaped than one would have surmised. And which is good. And that's what we need to see. We need to see that consumer confidence. And I also think that the likes of the VAT that has been scrapped, it also plays, probably we need to look at to say maybe the VAT scrapped, it also plays some part in that light commercial vehicle numbers. But we are really heading the right direction. And we can only hope that, you know, the policy uncertainties and the global challenges or global activities that are happening are not going to, you know, give some ideas to the Reserve Bank to hold on to interest rate cards in the future. So we can only pray and hope. But currently, things are looking much better than they were a year ago.
Yeah, 100%. We leave that there. Stembeng Kosipansi, Vice Chairperson, National Automobile Dealers Association. Appreciate the early morning time. And that's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Are you in the market for a new car? Have your vote, have your say. That's it for today. I was chatting with Peter Radenhaus yesterday from Herenia Capital Advisors, talking about trading different markets, trending versus volatile. 40% said trending way better. Rest split between volatile makes more money, or the rest of you saying no trading for you. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning on the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobukle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Sylvania Platinum Results.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now. On the money.